We're really excited about our next guest, John Turk. Amazing adventure. He has a PhD in organic chemistry he got at the University of Colorado back in 1971. He co-authored the first environmental science textbook in the U.S., and he's written about 25 of those since that time, and that, along with the three books that he's completed, allows him to seek big adventures. And by big adventures, he's completed a 3,000-mile kayak journey from Japan to Alaska, and which is described in his book, In the Wake of the Jomon. In that one, he was following a 10,000-year-old migration route. That trip is called one of the top 10 all-time sea kayak expeditions by Paddler Magazine. He also completed five expeditions back to northeastern Siberia, following a shaman's dream and his own healing quest, and that is covered in just an amazing book called The Raven's Gift. Recently, in fact, last year, he just completed a 1,485-mile expedition circumnavigating Ellesmer Island by ski, kayak, and foot. That's the first time that's ever been done, along with a partner on that expedition, which has been nominated as one of the top 10 adventures of 2012 by National Geographic Magazine. John, welcome back to the Roadhouse.
Hey, Buck. It's good to be back on the show again.
It's great to have you, and we just can't wait till hopefully sometime in the future when you come back to visit us.
I'd love that.
The first question I had about your last expedition, first of all, it's just an amazing adventure. Why Ellesmere Island? What connection did you have to that to decide to do this?
That's kind of a long story, Buck. Uh-huh. Way back a long time ago, I was dog sledding up the east coast of Baffin Island, which is quite a far south of Ellesmere. And we were out hunting with local folks to get food for our dogs and whatnot. And in every village, people came to us and said, "Oh, you guys are like Kitlock." And everybody would laugh hysterically. And nobody would tell us who Kitlock was. It was just like, "Oh, this is the funniest thing in the world." So when we finished that expedition, I came home and I looked him up. And this guy was a shaman, a murderer, a madman, and a quintessential traveler. So I figured, wow, you know, if I'm being equated with this madman, I may as well follow in his footsteps. So in 1988, my wife Chris Seashore and I followed the last part of Kitlock's migration, which was one of the great migrations to occur around the contact time when Europeans first came in contact. And he went up the coast, the east coast of Ellesmere, and across to Greenland to make a connection with the Inuit in northwest Greenland. So he did that trip in 1988. That was a long time ago. I thought at the time, this is one of the most beautiful, pristine places on Earth. And I thought about circumnavigating the island, but 1,500 miles, 100 days, 15 miles a day, half a marathon a day for over 3 months, I thought it was impossible. But over the years, it kind of ate on me, and people have been raising the bar and adventuring in every way, shape, and form, and I thought, well, maybe it was possible.
And off you went.
And then off we went, you bet.
Now, was there a connection then also for you, you know, with paddling that shore with your first wife, who you lost in a tragic avalanche back in 2005? Was that also part of
decision? Yeah. Okay, so I did that expedition in 1988 with Chris, my ex-wife, and as you correctly pointed out, she died in an avalanche in Eastern Sierra in 2005. So I guess two things came to a point, or three things or whatever. One is when something like that accident happens, when you lose a wife in that way, you never really come to closure with it, but you approach closure. And I thought that going around the island would somehow be a time to communicate with those years we spent together. And then, in addition, I was getting old. I was in my mid-60s. I thought that I had to go into the ice one more time. I felt that if I didn't do it now, I wouldn't get a chance because I'd get too old.
Mm-hmm. You're in your mid-60s now, and most these adventures that you're doing are beyond the scope of most people in the world. I mean, it's just amazing physical and mental challenge to do things like the 3,000-mile kayak trip and this latest one as well. Were you? How confident were you that you could do it? I know.
Well, confidence and foolishness, you know, sometimes go hand in hand. Hey, look, you have to be confident that you're going to pull something off of this nature. Rescue on the east coast of Ellesmere is possible, but very, very, very difficult. There are no landing strips for long stretches of the coast. You're out of helicopter range. We live in the 21st century. People can do this, but rescue is not something that you can count on. So when you put yourself in that realm, you're putting yourself in the realm where you're not going to ask for rescue. Once you set out, you're going to complete the journey. To do that, you have to be confident. As I say, confidence and foolishness might go hand in hand looking back at it. It might, well, you can call it whatever you want. That's your business. But you have to go out knowing that you're going to put yourself into the zone and you're going to complete the journey. I spent these 5 years with this shaman in northeast Siberia, as you mentioned in the introduction. That's all part of the Raven's Gift. And I spent a lot of time thinking about how far the human being can push their bodies, how far into what the shamans would call the ecstatic state that you can go beyond what you normally think you can go. This is nothing new. Every adventurer, whoever sets out on a big task, in some way, shape, or form, feels that they can go into that mode. And I just wanted to be in that headspace one more time.
As a partner on this pretty amazing journey, you know, nobody that we know of has ever done that before. Nobody's really circumnavigated Ellesmere, unless it was done by native folks at some point. I think you mentioned maybe there was some teenager back in who knows when.
Yeah, Jerry Kablenko mentions that. It wasn't documented. I think the important thing is that when you look at the scope of human migration from when Homo sapiens first evolved in Africa, moving across into Asia and across the steppe and into the high Arctic with the most primitive tools imaginable, did somebody go around Ellesmere Island and not write it up because there was no writing? Yeah, we don't know.
Sure. To go along on this journey, you found, I think he's 26 at the time, Eric Boomer, who was a professional kayaker. You didn't really know him.
Right. We didn't know him at all.
You didn't know him at all. And I know it's difficult to go on journeys like this anyway with people and get along because it's just very difficult under that kind of circumstances and 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You know, 4 weeks in a month. But there you were, somebody you didn't even know. How did that all go?
Well, it wasn't quite as much madness as it sounds like. There was a method to the whole concept. Again, a complicated story. I had this friend who was my age, Bill Bratt, whom I was a river kayaking friend in Montana where I live. And he had a son, Tyler. And Tyler, when Tyler was a young kid, 6, 7 years old, we, the community, his dad's friends, helped teach Tyler how to kayak. And then Kyler goes ahead and becomes a world-class kayaker. He has the world record waterfall jump, 182 feet.
Huh.
And I meet Tyler at a trade show in Salt Lake City, and all of a sudden this kid, whom I remember as a six-year-old kid, is now a 200-pound, broad-chested, strong-as-you-can-ever-get-out kind of guy, athletic, world-class kayaker, and he's working the floor trying to get sponsors just as I am. And I was like, wow, Tyler, man, hey, dude, you know, and high five, dude. And he goes, yeah, John, you know, before you get too old, we have to do a big expedition together, you know, the old and the young, blah, 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 the bridge of generations. And I go, yeah. Well, I never thought it would happen. He has his own world, his own generation. And then a few years later, he calls me up and he says, remember that conversation we had? Well, let's do it. So I say, okay. Now, I realize I haven't gotten to Eric here. So Tyler and I planned to do the trip. And this was all on, you know, all this spiritual stuff. We're going to be follow the strength of the old lady and everything. And then you sit down with the maps and the journals of the old explorers and the distances, and you start figuring out the actual logistics of the trip, and you go, ooh, this is going to be really hard. So Tyler looks up. We're sitting around going over maps and whatnot, and he says, we need more firepower. We need Eric Boomer. So we're in Hood River at the time. We get a hold of Eric. We meet him in a coffee shop. Hey, do you want to go on the hardest expedition you've ever conceived of in your entire life? And he goes, yeah, sure, that'd be okay. So I met Eric. The point I'm trying to make here is I met Eric through a connection, Tyler, whom I have a lot of deep respect for. Then Tyler went ahead and broke his back jumping a waterfall in his kayak, and it was me and Eric. Yes, we could have said, we don't know each other well enough, this is a bad idea. But I think there are certain people that you look at the accomplishments that they've done, you look into their eyes at the intensity, at the passion that they're living, and you say, this is going to work. And I always felt that with Boomer.
Hmm. Well, you sure seem to make it work, because 104 days on his expedition, and you're still friends.
Oh, way beyond friends. We just were together to do a joint slideshow at in Carbondale, Colorado here. And just being with him, I just felt the energy. I just felt this incredible energy that we shared on this trip that got us through the trip. Yeah, it was a wondrous thing that happened between us.
We're speaking with John Turk, and John, of course, is the author of The Raven's Gift and also In the Wake of the Djowman. John, last year completed circumnavigation of Ellesmere Island, he and his partner, Eric Boomer, being the first to do that. John, when the first time I ever saw a grizzly bear when I was outside, and of course the bear was too, I felt the kind of the, you know how you read about it, your hair kind of grows erect on the back of your neck, and you know something out there is bigger than you.
Right.
I've never experienced a polar bear.
Right.
But you did.
Oh yeah, we had lots of polar bear events. I think we counted 20 potentially aggressive polar bear events, and the closest that we got to one was we were in the tent sleeping, and he bit a hole in the tent and stuck his head in to check out the situation. So, yeah, we had a lot of polar bear accounts. So what do you make of that?
You know, I wonder what you'd do. I might just freeze up. I mean, obviously, you're still around, so you did the right things.
Yeah, I guess there's two questions, Buck. One is, what do you do? And the other is, how do you feel?
Yeah.
What do you do? Well, we had a 12-gauge shotgun handy as a last resort, as a backup. We never used it. We never shot a bear. We had these little firecracker things. They're called bear bangers, a little like a little rocket flare thing. They were pretty ineffective. The bear would kind of look at them going bang and just kind of shake its head like, I don't know what that was, but it's not very scary. But we did find that looking at the bear eyeball to eyeball and yelling at him worked.
Wow.
And we tried things like, I love you, and then we tried swear words, and profanity seemed to have a stronger effect on the bears than, I love you, please go away, even if it was shouted at the same intensity. So we'd swear at the bears, you know, say awful things about their mother and stuff like that.
And they'd go away.
They all went away every time.
Wow.
Now that's not a guarantee. Look, I don't want anybody to try that and fail and, you know, go back and say, well, John Turk told me to do that. A bear guy in Kamchatka, you were talking about grizzly bears, a bear guy in Kamchatka in Siberia told me that when you see a bear, you have to make an evaluation. Is that bear a dominant bear high on the order, on the pecking order in bear land? And if it is, you want to be subservient. Or is that bear low on the pecking order in bear land, and then you want to be dominant? So you have to read each bear and handle it accordingly. And, you know, of course, my answer is, well, how do you tell? And his answer was, well, you better learn fast. I think anybody who tells you how to deal with bears is only going to be, you know, take them with a grain of salt. Because there's an element of luck. It's the bear's attitude that day. It's the bear's, you know, predisposition. Did his wife give him a hard time last night, you know, or is things going pretty good? It's what that bear is feeling. And you can, no matter how much experience you have, you can end up in a really bad encounter with bears. But they are mammals. They're like your pet cat. They're like your pet dog. I do believe that there's a communication you can come up with this bear, with most bears, most of the time. And I think the best defense, short of using the 12-gauge, which you don't want to use, is to look at that bear in the eye and try to really figure out how angry is it, how crazed is it curious, is it really aggressive, and try to react accordingly.
Yeah, or avoidance seems to be the best the best tactic for me. John, this is 1,500 miles, and it's by kayak, by foot, and by ski. But you had to drag those kayaks. They didn't just follow you around when you're on your skis and on foot. And in quite a bit of the journey, I understand, you had no choice. That's just how you had to move because of the ice. You're in your mid-60s, as we mentioned before, and there's a lot of weight in those boats. That had to be an awful lot of work.
Well, yeah, of course. It wasn't like a big mistake or a big surprise.
Mm-hmm.
I routinely can travel 500 miles a month in a sea kayak. We had to go 1,500 miles. We could reasonably expect 1 month of open water and good weather. So the longest journey you can do in that far north is going to be 500 miles. Well, that puts us 1,000 miles short of what we wanted to do. So we left early, intentionally, when we knew it was going to be cold, when we knew the ocean was going to be frozen. And the reason we left on the early side rather than on the late side is when the ocean starts to freeze up, there's a time when it's too thin to walk on and too thick to paddle through, and you can't move at all. So we left early on purpose. We knew we were going to have to walk. What's it like to walk 1,000 miles on rough sea ice pulling a very heavily loaded boat? Well, that was the whole That was the whole concept of the expedition, is to go farther and harder than you ever imagined your body could do it. And that's the ecstasy, that's the ecstatic state, that's pushing yourself to the limit beyond which you are a rational human being. I would like to add, and you might be bringing this up, that I pushed myself in the end right to the limit of death. When we completed the expedition, we went the whole way around the island, 104 days, completed the expedition, and then 39 hours later, my body went into metabolic shutdown, and I came very, very close to dying. So, how do you do it? What's it like? It's going beyond pain. But I don't want to make it sound like I'm suffering, because, yeah, it was hard work, but it was a really joyful experience, and I'm not just, like, saying that for the media. It was something that put you into a zone that I've never been in before and never will be there again, and that was great.
Yeah, as you say, it wasn't a surprise to you. It was what you were expecting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were times you asked in the beginning, how did you reasonably expect? How were you confident that you could do it? Part of it was a certain amount of denial. You go out any day and you walk 15 miles. Okay, now you walk 15 miles pulling a couple of tires or some sort of something that'll slow you down. And you're pretty tired at the end of that day. So from the beginning, what makes you think you could do that every single day for months on end? And, if you, like, hit me with a rational question in a rational way, I'll have to kind of bumble and mumble and shake my head and look at my shoes and pretend I didn't really hear you.
We talked a little bit about bears, but they weren't the only obstacle they had, and, of course, the difficulty of the journey. I think you had to tangle a little bit with a few walruses that were out there as well.
We had one walrus attack. It attacked a boomer, not me, which was good because he had better reflexes than I think I would have had. This thing, they're 3,000 pounds. They're, you know, they weigh as much as two horses. So this is a big animal. And they got these big, long teeth attached to them, you know. And this walrus, and they're amazingly fast and agile and graceful in the water. This animal shoots under his bow and comes up, and I look, and I see the tusks right above his head, and I had a flash moment that this was really, 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 really bad. It almost knocks Boomer over. He just about capsizes. He throws a brace. Keeps himself from capsizing, comes off the brace, and whacks the guy in the nose. And that seemed to do the trick because we got away and we didn't get impaled on those huge tusks. But polar bears and walrus attacks are, you know, good media press. The real danger and the biggest obstacle we had was the moving ice, the compression of the ice.
Now, because that island, I know it's a lot of cliffs, it's a very mountainous island, so the wind and the ice probably were a big deal when the ice is pushing you right towards cliffs.
Yeah, the big concern, Buck, was when we got to the northeast corner of the island, we knew this is a place where Ellesmere Island, northeast corner of Ellesmere and the northwest Greenland, are 12 miles apart. I had talked to a lot of people about the ice in this region, including your own hometown hero, Lonnie Dupree. And we knew that the ice in here was going to be very, 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 very rough. Lonnie had been on the Greenland side in his classic and heroic circumnavigation of Greenland. so we knew that the ice in here was going to be rough. And what you have is that the wind is driving that ice, the wind and the currents, south. And you have the whole North Pole ice pack out there, and it's being compressed into a funnel 12 miles wide. So you have thousands of miles of ice trying to get through this little channel, and the compression in there is very, very, it's powerful to the point where you have football field sizes, chunks of ice 6 feet thick, smearing up, turning on edge, raising into the air, smashing into each other, buckling, crashing. And this is the zone where to make it through in a kayak takes a little bit of, well, you get scared. You get really scared in there.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it. I know there's, just from this conversation we've had, there's many things to be scared about have already occurred. You know, this is it's an amazing adventure. You mentioned earlier that you kind of reached pretty close to your limits as far as what you can physically do and what anybody can physically do on this kind of a journey. Will you have an adventure like this again? What did it tell you about what you want to do?
Yeah. No, the answer is no. I'm not going to go this hard ever again. At the same time, I'm not going to quit adventuring. I think that, you know, part of aging gracefully, and we're all age if we're lucky, and aging gracefully is our choice. I think part of aging gracefully is retiring when the writing is on the wall. And the difficulty of having my body break down, go into metabolic shock at the end of this trip, which was an age-related thing, and the realization that, you know, that was cute, but not that cute, and I shouldn't do it again. It would be irresponsible. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm really good with this. This was my final exam, my graduation party. Great. And I'm totally, totally happy and content with my body the way it is. I'm going to continue to do expeditions. I'm not going to push it at that limit again.
John, you have a website out there that people can read about this last journey. I understand that you may or may not write about it in a larger venue.
Yeah, my website is pretty simple. It's www.johnturk.net. And so I have a lot of stuff up on that. I think I got one more book in me, Buck, that would include this trip. It wouldn't be a trip report. What I'm interested in talking about these days, rather than a specific journey, we went here and we suffered and we persevered and we came home alive. Yeah, that's okay, but it doesn't really hold together for a whole book in my mind. I'm talking about the spiritual value of wilderness, the value of understanding our heritage, our Stone Age heritage. It's not that I'm saying we should all, live in caves and eat roots and berries and stuff, but to understand where we came from, to understand that for 2 million years we survived, we thrived, we migrated, we traveled with very, very, very primitive tools, but with a spirituality, a connectivity to the earth, a community, a relationship with ourselves and our environment. And to me, as we go into the 21st century, our survival will depend on our ability to, in some way, recall those strengths. And so if I'm going to write about anything, that's the theme I'm going to be working with. And I'll use the Ellesmere trip as an example, as a metaphor, but not as the main theme of the book.
As John mentioned, you can find out more at his website. I think it's johnturk.net.
JohnTurk.net, yeah.
Yes. And
if you go to johnturk.com, you'll get something written in Turkish, and you probably won't be able to understand it.
And at that website, you can also see his three books, The Raven's Gift, just a remarkable story about his travels with a shaman in northeast Siberia. Also, In the Wake of the Jomon, the fabulous 3,000-mile kayak trip he did from Japan to Alaska, and his initial trip to Ellesmere Island in cold oceans. John's also available for, in fact, you do a lot of speaking. I believe that's what you're out in Boulder doing right now, isn't it, John?
Yeah, it sort of exploded. It's an interesting transition, Buck, because... I've been working on this show. I've been studying motion. I work with a dance company now in Boston, and I've been trying to turn this show into more of a one-man performance than a slideshow. And it's been really fun to, you know, become a wandering storyteller in the old sense. And the amount of speaking that's been coming my way has been rather explosive lately. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm doing a lot of talking.
That's great. You know, John, it's been great to have you on the program. Really fun to hear from you. And as I mentioned, we sure hope that that we'll run into each other and in this community as well sometime in the future.
Well, thank you, Buck. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks for joining us. John Turk.